Welcome to the Sunshine Parenting Podcast. My name is Audrey Monkey, and I am your host. Here on the podcast and on my website at sunshine-parenting.com, I write, research, speak, and interview podcast guests on the topics of summer camp, parenting, and happiness. I believe that together we can raise a generation of happy, connected kids who bring positive changes to this world. On my website and podcast, I share ideas, stories, and tips to help parents and anyone else who works with young people raise competent, kind, optimistic kids. I'm so excited to be talking in this episode with Stephen Gray Wallace. He is the executive director of the Center for Adolescent Research and Education and has extensive experience working as a camp director as well. I've been following Stephen's work for many years, including an article in Psychology Today published last June about how summer camps are essential organizations for children's moral growth. I hope you enjoy this episode of the podcast. So for this episode of the podcast, I'm at the American Camp Association Conference, and I'm here with Stephen Wallace, whose work I've been covering for quite some time. He has a lot to offer parents, especially in the area of teens and working with teens. And so, Stephen, why don't you just start by introducing yourself, kind of all the different things that you do, all the different hats you wear.
Thanks, Audrey. A lot of hats. So I'm here at the American Camp Association Conference, as you are, because I'm a camp director at both an overnight and day camp on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. And one of the things that I do there is run a teen leadership program, which we believe is one of the largest in the country. And I believe you have a teen program at your camp as well, if I
recall. We do. Yeah. How many kids do you have in your teen program?
We have about generally 150 to 160 14 to 17-year-olds.
Great.
Just in our overnight program. Mm-hmm. Then we have a separate teen program in our day camp. So I do that. That's a year-round commitment, but full-time for about 5 months, mm-hmm. Covering the spring, summer, and early fall. My other big job is I run a national nonprofit that I founded in 2011 called the Center for Adolescent Research and Education, or CARE. And CARE is really a collaborative of institutions and organizations from all over the country. We have about 46, 47 collaborating institutions and organizations from big research universities like Clemson and Penn State and Wake Forest and Coastal Carolina University to hospital systems, to national media platforms such as Psychology Today, HuffPost, Campy Magazine, mm-hmm. NBC Universal, Teen Life Media, etc. We have a lot of national nonprofits, including the American Camp Association, mm-hmm. that line up with our 8 key cohorts of youth influencers, so peers, parents, teachers, coaches, camp counselors, of course, physicians, mental health professionals, and faith-based mentors. So what we did is we went out and we recruited national organizations that represent each of those cohorts, like the American Camp mm-hmm. Association for Camp Counselors, like the American Academy of Family Physicians for doctors, like the National Association of School Psychologists for mental health professionals, and so forth. And then we have a small group of for-profit collaborators that align with mission. So we mm-hmm. don't go out and just look for any corporate
right.
entity to join our collaborative. They have to have some buy-in to what we're doing. So we're doing work with some companies now that are focused on things like the opioid epidemic, suicide, things like that.
Mm-hmm. So you're basically trying to provide education and
right.
training
right.
to all these different groups
right.
with your outcome, what we talked earlier, is to basically help raise healthy, happy, functioning teens? Or what would you say is like the overall thing is getting
sure.
better outcomes for these kids?
Yeah, so we are highly focused on promoting favorable youth outcomes. Things like positive identity formation, character development, leadership, civic engagement, social entrepreneurship, media and financial literacy, conflict resolution. And then in the second instance, we're focused on prevention, on mm-hmm. Working on issues like youth suicide, mm-hmm. like prescription drug use mm-hmm. by young people, the opioid epidemic, those types of things.
So you do research and education on
right.
these.
Right. So our name comes from the fact that we're focused on adolescents. And we do research. We do primary research, our own original research, and we do a lot of secondary research. So we promote research done by certainly our collaborators, mm-hmm. our nonprofits, our research universities, and other research. So through our media platform, we publish probably between 4 and 6 pieces a month, all research-based, with an occasional opinion editorial thrown in. I actually wrote in about 15 minutes an op-ed on Thursday about the school shooting near me in Florida. Mm-hmm. Ironically, Wednesday morning, hours before the shooting, I was on a call with one of the co-founders of Sandy Hook Promise, which is one of our collaborators, and another collaborator called The Social Good. And they're working, working together to utilize this technology that allows people to monitor publicly available social media postings to identify, for example, people who are at risk of harming themselves or harming others, so there can be intervention. Mm-hmm. So that's a big initiative of ours. We're also working with McCann World Group, which is part of McCann Erickson, the behemoth, the advertising agency, on a campaign around youth prescription drug use. And that's anchored by a very cool short video that McCann produced called Pay the Price. And a lot of original techniques used in filming that, and it's available on our blog at ecareforkids.org. So we'll be building in additional elements of that campaign as we go forward.
Probably a lot of parents listening won't be going and looking back at the research and all of this. It's amazing work that's so important. I think one of the things that you say on your website and that I want to kind of hone in on is if you're speaking with parents, say at a school, and they're parents of maybe high school kids, what are a few of the things that you really want to make sure you communicate to parents of teens, given your vast knowledge of what's going on with teens and the ways they're suffering and what helps them, and your work with the kids at camp? So what are some of the words of wisdom or advice that you would give to parents who are really fearful right now? Right. You know, you mentioned all these things, suicide and prescription drugs. And so for parents thinking about their own children, what are some things that they can do that would help have better outcomes, hopefully, for their kids?
Well, I spend a lot of time talking with parents.
Yes.
And, you know, my biggest message is you are an incredibly important role model in your child's life, a critically important mentor. We've done a lot of original research around mentoring, not necessarily formal mentoring, like matched mentoring, mm-hmm. such as, you know, boys and girls clubs,
right,
or
right.
big brother, big sister, but what we call natural mentors, which are mentors that young people find in their everyday lives. And we went out and asked them, who are those people? Mm. And they named people like our teachers, our coaches, our parents. Parents were one of the most highly rated group of mentors that young people said, and grandparents. Grandparents are incredibly
awesome.
Influential. Mm-hmm. And I know that from living it in my mm-hmm. own life.
Mm-hmm.
Parents often sort of walk away from their children when they become teenagers because they think, not literally, but sort of emotionally, because they think that they don't really count anymore, that their children aren't dialed into what they have to say.
Mm.
And ironically, teenagers, as you know, are sort of programmed to act that way, because part of their developmental prerogative is to begin to separate from their mm-hmm. parents and to focus more on their peer group and move from what we call an external locus of control, where people are telling them what to do, to an internal locus mm-hmm. of control, where they're telling themselves what to do. And so parents get this message that, oh, my kid doesn't really want to hear from me. He or she doesn't want to talk to me about mm-hmm. this, that, or the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the exact opposite of that is true. And that's what our research shows, is that when you look at young people that make what we call good choices, the number one reason is parents.
Mm-hmm.
So stay dialed in. Keep the communication going. Kids do want to talk to you. They may act like they don't, but they do.
So I think when your kid is in that stage where they're starting to pull away, what advice do you have for parents? How to respond to them? How do you keep that relationship and connection when they are doing some pushback?
Right. Well, I think that obviously you want to give your kids some space as they're getting older. Give them more responsibility. Let them make some more decisions. Pick your battles. Helicopter parenting is different than remaining an involved parent. The two completely different constructs. your child, I guarantee you, if you're a helicopter parent, are going to get to college or get to the next step in life and be dysfunctional. They need to learn how to make those choices by themselves. But they need you as a partner. I have a chart in my book. I wrote a book called Reality Gap, which is about that lack of information. And it looks at what teens are doing in real life compared to what their parents think they're doing. Mm-hmm. And there's an enormous difference.
Mm-hmm.
But in the book, I have a chart. And along the top, it says mine, ours, and theirs. And then down the side are a list of different issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, curfews, bedtimes, homework, drinking, drugs, other drugs, you know, those types of things. And what I say is that as your child matures, you should see check marks in those columns moving from left to right. So when they're younger, it's my decision. I'm the parent. I decide. Mm-hmm. As they get a little bit older, it becomes a joint decision. We work it out together. Although there's some caveats to that. You know, drinking and other drugs, not going to happen, right? As long as they're under the age of 21. But then as they start to move through high school, some of those check marks should be moved into theirs. It's their decision. Because some things aren't, as I said, aren't worth the battle. Like how they wear their hair. Who cares? You know, if they're 16 years old, let them decide how they want to wear their hair.
Right.
Or maybe they have more leeway in deciding when they're going to go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sure, maybe you have a curfew when they have to be in the house.
Right.
But it's not like when they were 8 and you said, okay, you need to be in bed, you know, with your eyes closed at, you know, 8:30 or whatever it might be.
Right.
So you have to sort of learn to mm-hmm. relinquish some control, but maintain that open, honest, direct dialogue. And we all know of all the parenting styles that are discussed that authoritative parenting is the most effective. It's high on demand, meaning mm-hmm. we expect a lot of our
mm-hmm.
children. We explain to them why we have those expectations, but it's also very high on warmth. It's very
mm-hmm.
nurturing. That's the best model to follow.
Definitely. I was thinking as you were saying that, so I agree with that because by the time they go to college, for example, and I know you talk about this a lot, the transition from high school to college, how it's very tough, especially if you're thinking about a kid who maybe hasn't been doing that much for themselves or hasn't been working on figuring out how to make their own choices, then to be put in this environment where they have 100% freedom. There's been a lot of issues. Why don't you talk about some of that, how that first semester of college and some of those issues that are coming up and how parents can better prepare kids for that transition?
Yeah, we're doing a lot of work around transitions. And of course, one of the most problematic ones is the transition from high school to college, because all of a sudden they've gone from a, you know, fairly structured and relatively supervised environment to, in many cases, really being on their own and having a new peer group with which they're not nearly as connected to as the peer group they grew up with. You know, they may appear to be very connected, but I hear this from parents all the time. They go to the first parents' weekend at college, and they say, oh, my God, my kid knows everybody. He or she has more friends. Many, overwhelming number of college students report being very lonely and feeling very isolated. Even
right.
though they have these friendships, they're not deep in nature. They're sort of casual. I mean, they may
right.
know a lot of people's names
right.
and be able to wave at people across, you know, as they're walking across campus. Hey, Audrey, how you doing? But that doesn't necessarily mean they have
right.
deep friendships.
Right.
So we really need to start preparing young people when they're still in high school for those transitions
right.
and life skills. I had a friend who was at a college recently to speak, and she was in line to get some lunch, and she was at the salad bar, and she said the young man in front of her, who was a first-year student, stopped, pulled out his cell phone and called his mom and said, Mom, I don't know what kind of dressing I should put on my salad.
Oh, no.
So we've also done research around risk behavior among first-semester college
mm-hmm.
students, and that's so important to help your child make some decisions about what choices they want to make during
mm-hmm.
those critical first few months of college, because
mm-hmm.
those decisions may very well inform the decisions for the rest of their tenure in college.
Right.
So what are they going to do when they go to a fraternity party?
Mm-hmm.
What are your expectations? What decisions do you hope they'll make around
mm-hmm.
drinking or other drug
mm-hmm.
use or sexual behavior
mm-hmm.
or you name it. They have the freedoms. The choices are there. They're going to have to make them. They're all there.
Right.
I spoke at a parents' weekend at a university in Pennsylvania a couple of years ago, and I did a round table on Sunday morning just to see what parental impressions were about their child's
right.
first semester at college. And this one dad raised his hand and he said, I'm just blown away. He said, my son, when he was in high school, was kind of a stay at home. He had a few close friends. He was a good student. He worked hard, you know, had a job. He came to college, and now he said all he's doing is going to fraternity parties, getting drunk, and having sex.
Oh, my gosh. And he's like, that's not what I wanted for him. Yeah. But did he have that conversation? That's the thing that I think is interesting.
He didn't know how to have that conversation.
Right. And this is one of those things that's very uncomfortable as parents. And I know, you know, because we have two teenage boys still at home. So there's been a lot of, you know, this whole Me Too and all this stuff. And so we're having these, we just make ourselves have these uncomfortable conversations now a lot. And just explaining to them, just this is what's happening.
Right.
This is what's happening in the world. You're part of this world. You're going to be out there, you know, and you need to understand the, you know, the dangers of different things and what's going on. And it's kids
That's
really
so important.
Appreciate it. And we'll just say something, well, do you have any questions? And, you know, that kind of thing. And it's awkward as parents, because I think most of us didn't have parents who talked to us about these things. And I think a lot of parents assume their kid who in high school was just doing fine is going to be the same. And you're right. It's if you don't have those conversations and you don't share your values or help them figure out what theirs are, I think that it's really it's a challenge for them. I think this is where camp, I think, and we can just circle back and kind of end with this. When you think about, I know at my camp, and I know it's the same at yours, teenagers really, I think, appreciate and thrive in a setting where there's very high standards and very high nurture. Mm-hmm. It's like we provide the structure that they need to thrive. What are your thoughts on that? Because this is where I think why these kids, they're wanting to come back to our camps as 17-year-olds, old teenagers who, where a lot of their peers are at home doing very different things during the summer. They're choosing and signing up to come to a place where very clear and distinct guidelines about drugs and alcohol and sex and phones, all that stuff. So what are your thoughts on why, on that whole camp, how good camp is for teenagers?
Oh, I could talk for hours on that.
I knew you could.
I've written a lot about it. I just was asked by Teen Life Media to write a piece that's called Top 10 Reasons Why Your Teenager Should Go to Summer Camp. And
I'll be sharing that one for sure.
Of course, there's a top 100 reasons, but you name some of them. It's sort of the independence, being away from home, being closely connected with kids. I mean, my kids in my teen leadership program at Cape Cod Sea Camps, they talk about what it's like to live in a cabin for 7 weeks with, you know, 12 or 13 other 14, 15, 16-year-olds, and what a great experience that is and how close they feel to their friends. The other thing that kids always say about camp, as I'm sure you hear this as well, is I do things at camp I would never do in a million years at home, because at camp I can be me. Mm-hmm. That's probably the most resonant thing I hear from young people. I get to be me at summer camp. I'm accepted, I'm nurtured, I'm loved, and yes, those high expectations. You know, I'm big on expectations. I mean, if you talk to my campers, they'll tell you, you know, they have to walk the line.
Right.
But I'm also incredibly nurturing. They, you know, they get home and their parents call me and they say, they just love that. You know, like you lay out the expectations, you hold them accountable, but they're surrounded by all of these caring adults who really are invested in their happiness and their success.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's just a model that parents can really learn from, and schools. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I think, I mean, you and I feel the same way. I meet so many fabulous young people. Just amazing. I have a perspective of young people from the teenagers at our camp to the counselors, the young adults. Of course, we get to see this really phenomenal group of people who are not living the same as what maybe a lot of kind of people perceive as teenagers. And I think the lesson from that is that we can create cultures in our families, in schools, in all different settings, following the same model.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's just the thing. Well, this has been so much fun. I'm going to put links to your website and everything from in the show notes from this podcast. But thank you so much for being on the podcast today, Stephen. It's really great talking to you. We'll have to do it again, too.
Absolutely.
I learned so much talking with Stephen Wallace, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of the podcast and learned a lot as well. For notes, links, and information about what we talked about, visit my website at sunshine-parenting.com and search for episode 27. I'll leave you with a quote that really was profound to me from my interview with Stephen Wallace. You are an incredibly important role model in your child's life, a critically important mentor.